Good evening. At this time, Mel and Vic begin the TechNet on my mark. TechNet number 1169 of the series that began in September of 1982. Main purpose of the TechNet is education, information, a little bit of humor occasionally sneaks in there, but ham radio is a very complicated hobby. How do you get the best out of it? How do you make things work? How do things work? How does this wireless stuff really perform? The TechNet consists of a bunch of people coming together, teaching each other that art and science. Wireless radio, combined with and without computers. A person signs into the TechNet by giving Mel and Vic your call letters, your name, and a yes after that that says you do have a question or a comment for the net. Please give me your call letters and name at this time. KQRIW listening.
Intuio, Rich, and yes.
KQ2, QIQ, no for now.
WS2N, Paul. No, good evening, Dick.
W2GOD, Steve. No.
WB7AVF, Rob. No.
TC2OLA, Mike, no.
Good evening all, this is T2KEY.
KC2MDP, Steve, and yes, Dick.
Okay, so far we've got Mel, Rich, QIQ, Steve, Bob, Mike, Paul, and another Steve with a real question, KC2MDP. Anyone else check it? Give me your call letters and name at this time.
This is KC2QYW. The name is Joe, and yes.
KC2OES, Fred, and yes.
Okay, Joe and Fred with a yes. More than enough. Let's go over to Rich and 2EO. Your voice is sounding better. Possibly you've decreased the number of cigarettes. N2EO, K2RIW. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick, K2RIW, TechNet, Weimark, N2EO. Well, I did. I eliminated cigarettes last Thursday. And this week I got to go for a biopsy on the throat, and we'll see what the story is. Dick, got a question. I purchased a Kenwood TS 2000X. If you're not familiar with the radio, it's got quite a wide frequency expanse, covers 160 meters, right up to 62440, and the X model, which covers 1.2 gigahertz. I bought the Kenwood software with it. I'm not too impressed with the software that Kenwood's putting out. Not really sure what I'm looking for in software, but I thought maybe somebody had a recommendation on some aftermarket software for this radio. Back to net and 2EO.
Yeah, I think the TS-2000 in its original form has been around for a couple of years. I'd like to believe someone has written some software for it by now, but maybe not. Also, that's quite a radio, 160 meters up to what I call 1296, 1.2 gigs. I'm guessing it does not include 220 and the 902 band. I can well understand that. Those two bands are relatively small in popularity, but all those other bands, boy, that's a lot of bands in one radio. Alrighty, I'll pass the word out. We'll put out the question. I'll be a little bit amazed if someone knows of software. So, Rich's question is, do we know of any aftermarket software for the Kenwood TS 2000X radio? Has anyone else written software to work with it? If you have any hint or know if it's by second party or third hand or whatever, give us a call at us right now. K2RIW in the TechNet. I was a little bit afraid of that one, Rich. By way of an internet search, I think Did somebody say they've got the knowledge of software? Yeah. By way of an internet search, there's probably a number of Kenwood websites, I'd like to believe. I know that there used to be a Vox Tango website, which I guess is for Yaesu radios. So there may very well be a Kenwood site. I would try that. After that, I don't know what to try, what to tell you. And by the way, if a person was, I'm changing subject now, if a person was smoking two packs a day, I am guessing a pack of cigarettes is $5 a pack. That's $10 a day, 365 days, $3,650 a year. A person could buy a brand new rig every year. A good
$27 a pack here in the city, Dick.
That means you could buy a $4,000 rig. See where I'm going? Wow. Not only are they dangerous, but they're expensive. Okay, it shows you what I know. Okay, yeah. I guess we have to keep an ear out for an eye out for any software for the TS-2000. One last call. Anybody have any knowledge on that subject?
WA2MO.
WA2, Mike Oscar. Start off with your name, sir, and whatever you know on that subject.
Yeah, very good, Dick. I was just listening in. Just happened to tune across the band here. And anyway, the name here is Mark, Mike Alpha Romeo Kilo, and I'm located here in Patchogue, Long Island. Anyway, a quick answer to your question regarding software. I assume it's computer-aided software. But if you go to www.november4papayankee.com, I believe it is, but that's the guy's call anyway, November4papayankee. He writes software for quite a plethora of radios, including, and I'm looking here right now at the website, it's one of the radios this guy writes software for is for the TS-2000, as it states right now. Back to you, Dick.
Well done, Mark. Awful glad you came along with that information. Relatively unknown to us. So that's a good lead. To your knowledge, Mark, is he the only guy who supplies software for multiple rigs, aftermarket computer control software? Do you believe he's the only one, or should Rich also dig deeper and see if he can find another one? Back to you, Mark.
Yeah, okay, Dick. Yeah, I believe you may want to do a Google search on another program called Ham Radio Deluxe. That's another program, I believe, written by a gentleman in the UK. I don't know his call. I have used both programs on my Orion, and they both do a pretty good job as far as controlling the radio via the computer. But if you do a Google search, I'm sure there's other software out there. The Ham Radio Deluxe package is free. It doesn't cost a dime. You just download it. But you're going to have to, like I said, do a Google search on Ham Radio Deluxe, and then you can see what radios it will control. It controls a wide variety of radios. I'm sure it will do the 2000. The N4PY software it does cost money. It's, I believe, the it says it right here. First-time registration is $65, and then annual renewal is $30. And it comes with any updates, of course, free of charge as needed. So you may want to check those two programs. Back to you, Dick.
Very good information, Mark. Well done. Mark, do you know of any of your friends who have paid the $65 for the November 4 Papa Yankee program? Do you know anyone who has stepped up to the plate, paid the money, used it, and said, yeah, it's fantastic and much better than what Kenwood supplies? Have you heard any hints along those lines, Mark, or or do you believe the software is too new for it to have established a track record yet? Back to you, Mark.
Yeah, fine, Dick. I am, right now, I have not renewed my subscription with the November 4 Papa Yankee. I have an Orion, Dick, and I use the software on occasion with the Orion. It makes the radio a little bit more flexible and a little bit more easier to use rather than just pressing a bunch of buttons. Sometimes I like the point and click capability, and the software is rock solid. Really haven't had any problems with it. And I haven't renewed, not because I don't want to, but because of laziness. I will be renewing it again soon so I can get, you know, continued support for any necessary updates that are needed for the program. But I do know that the gentleman who writes the N4PY software, if you have some issues with his software or would like to see some improvements made to it to make it a little bit more functional, he will think, you know, he'll look it over, see if it's doable and make the necessary changes. I know I had a couple of issues with the software, and I had made some suggestions, which he did eventually implement into into an update for everybody to make the program more and more functional. So, and the Ham Radio Deluxe is a little different. I know you can email the gentleman who writes the software, but the updates just don't come out as quick. So it's just a matter of what you want to do. If you want to pay for it, fine, or if you want to get it free, you know, that's fine, too. They both work good, Dick. Back to you.
Hi, Dick. Yeah, I've got another whole question for you, and I'm going to get back to you two transmissions downrange, Rich. Stand by there for a second. I'm getting a brand new impression of all the extra information you're giving me, Mark. At first, I thought $65 allows you access to the software for a Kenwood TS-2000X. By the way you're talking right now, I have the impression that Carl Moreschi, his name, N4 Papa Yankee, has a software package for $65 for registry and some number of $10 or whatever per year to stay current, which is apparently software for many radios, not just the Kenwood TS-2000 or 2000X. Many radios, multiple radios. Correct me on that one when I pass it back to you, Mark. On top of that, I attended a conference of the Microwave Update in Philadelphia a month ago in October, and a major portion of that conference was on the subject of software-defined radio, SDR. And the prediction there was that the progressive microwave enthusiasts, in a small number of years, more than half of them will exclusively be using software-defined radios. So the tie-in of a computer in our radios looks like it is a given. Only left to discuss is how much and when, and how much it's going to cost, and how many extra features we're going to get. So am I correct in guessing from what you're telling me, Mark, that this N4 Papa Yankee program controls many, if not all, radios that have a software external plug capability? WA2, Mike Oscar, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick. Yeah, well, the program that he writes, for example, the Tentec software obviously is not going to be able to run the Kenwood product. From what I gather here is that the a lot of the Kenwood radios are probably all using a very similar, I guess, language, if you want to call it that, a routine. As far as for computer control. So, for example, the Kenwood software will control, the Kenwood products. Now, it might, some other radios might also probably have the same type of command language. So, even though it is a Kenwood radio, a program written for Kenwood, it still might actually operate another vendor's product, too. So I'm I'll correct myself as far as, you know, a program specific for one brand of radio. I think that that other radio manufacturers probably do use the same routine command. But yes, I would say that the answer to that question is yes, that a particular program might control other radios as well as the Kenwood 2000. Dick, back to you.
Very good. And I've got another question to follow up on that, but I'm going to pass it over to Rich. He wants to make sure he gets his question into you. We found somebody with a lot of thoughts on the subject. Go ahead, Rich. N2EO, K2LIW, and the Tech Man.
Hey, very good.
And EJ recognized. We'll get to you in a second, too. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, fine. I was somewhat familiar with the N4PY software, because I also own an Orion 2, and that was my question. If I buy that software, do I have to buy one or two if I want to run it, say, in the Orion 2 and the TS2000X? But what put me off on the N4PY software is he doesn't accept credit cards. You got to mail him a check, and he snail mails you a copy. You know, if it was possible to download a copy, like to pay him by credit card and download a copy, I would do it tonight. Back to that N2EO.
Yeah, for N4 Papa Yankee, not to, to call Marishi, not to take credit cards over the internet, and also to want real cash, and then to snail mail it to you. I got some guesses as to why he's doing that. I recently bought some things by the internet, and after that I received a bunch of messages by people claiming to be the credit card, asking for additional information, and of course they were phony. Eric, we're going to pass it over to you. You're a person who's had a lot of connection with software, radios, and whatever. To your knowledge, Eric, my question, I know you're about to give us information, but my question also added to you is there a movement afoot that you know of in order to try to set standardization of the protocol that communicates with our radios? It sure would be nice if someone has come up with a standardized protocol so that there is the possibility of a skeleton key, so to speak. A program could be written where it has the possibility of controlling Kentech, Kenwood, ICOM, Yaesu, and so on. KE2EJ. K2LIW. You got it, Eric.
Yeah, Roger, Dick. First of all, can you copy me? I'm out by Sheldon. I'm hanging back to the job. Can you copy? I'll wait a little bit.
You sound loud and clear. Beautiful. Please proceed.
All right. First of all, you'll find that there's a difference between the command protocols of the various different manufacturers. They're not even close to the same. I've written a bunch of stuff for various different kinds of radios. The protocols for individual radios within a line vary somewhat, but most Kenwood radios are similar, most Yaesu radios are similar, and most ICOM radios are similar for remote control. It's basically an ASCII protocol which says that if you hit this number, you're talking about the frequency entry, another string of numbers, it'll be what mode, whether it be FM, AM, sideband. And that's not what we would call a software-defined radio. A software-defined radio is basically a front end and a DSP. And it works the other way, a DSP and multipliers and an alpha transistor. That being a software-defined radio, either a DSP or a VLSI, which you could turn into a DSP, you know, such as like a Linux chip or a Cirrus chip. Those kinds of things, what you do is you put a program in them, or you actually, in some of the ASICs, you sort of draw a circuit of a demodulator or a modulator, depending upon the type of transmission that you're doing. As far as I know, and I may not know too well, but as far as I know, the manufacturers are kind of sticking to their own guns. They started with the early radios with their protocols and kept going. One of the things that you'll find is that many of the different software programs like, say, satellite tracking programs and some other stuff, you'll find that they generally do, even some of the PSK programs and stuff, they generally put all three protocols in their programs so they can deal with anybody's product. But as far as the standardization goes, I kind of doubt it. K2RIW, K2J.
Thanks an awful lot, Eric. Good information from both you and Mark. And Mark and Eric, we're indebted to both of you guys. I'm very light on computer knowledge. I'm a user. I'm a, what's the word we used to use now? An appliance operator when it comes to computers. When it comes to microwave equipment, there's where I claim I've got some smarts. But on computers, I pray the darn thing keeps going. My handheld favorite calculator is starting to give me glitches, and I'm in a fair amount of trouble along those lines because I carry the thing in my pocket and get answers out of it five times per day. Mark, with all that we've just discussed, I wonder if there's anything else you want to add. And boy, are we glad that you came along. And when it comes to giving out prizes at the end of the year, you're going to be on the top of our list, Mark. W82, Mike Oscar, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Nick. Yeah, I'll tell you, it was just by chance. I just was scanning through the my programmed frequencies I have in the ray gear. And I said, oh, the net's on. And so I figured, let me sit back and listen for a while, and bingo, something I could answer. glad I could help. Yeah, I wanted to add one more thing. A comment was made. I think it's called N2EO, if I'm not mistaken, but anyway, about he doesn't accept, he only accepts money orders or whatever. That's not really the case. If you go to his website, he does use PayPal, and which is, I believe, www.paypal.com, and you can actually send payment to him via via that method, right over the internet. You don't necessarily have to be a member. You can, you know, use a credit card right through PayPal. It's secure. I'm not really, I have nothing to do with PayPal except that I have used it myself. So if you wanted to do a credit card transaction, it is possible through PayPal. Dick, go ahead.
Hey, that doesn't surprise me. I think eBay uses PayPal. I think Amazon uses PayPal. I'm not even sure it's possible eBay bought PayPal or vice versa. So there's a close tie-in there. And I have made payments by way of PayPal to Amazon. I've also, Amazon or to eBay. And I think I've also done it directly with my credit card. Okay, Rich, any other questions? N2 Echo Oscar, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, just real quick to sum it up. You're saying if I want to pay him by PayPal, I do not need a PayPal account, Dick?
I did establish a PayPal account for me, and at the time, because I already have another credit card and credit history and no liens against my property, it seemed to me pretty easy. It seemed like I was able to do it all in one evening. I'll admit I did it a year and a half or 2 years ago. I'm not quite sure what the rules are like right now, but to establish a PayPal account, my memory is that it was quite easy, Rich. Go ahead.
All right. I've never been comfortable with that because I've heard too much fraud going on, or possible fraud. What I'm going to do is call N4PY, see what the story is. Maybe I can give him a Visa number right over the phone.
That's worth a try. But if at worst he wants PayPal, as long as you personally go straight to PayPal and by way of a encrypted internet connection to them, I would trust that. I've bought an awful lot of stuff over the internet. I've never had any trouble. Where you got to be careful is that before, if out of the blue you get an email from somebody claiming to be your credit card, PayPal, or whatever, asking additional information, then I'd be very skeptical because there's all kinds of scams going along there. But when you call them directly or when you email them directly and you establish a encrypted path to them, I think 99% of the time you're safe. I'd go for it. for a man of your resources, I wouldn't worry about it. On top of that, most credit cards have some kind of a insurance policy tied into them, so I think you're moderately safe in the forward direction. Just look out for the reverse direction. Good luck with that process, Rich, and let us know in the future how well it turns out. Next person who signed in with a real question was Glenn. KC2QIQ, you got it, Glenn.
Oh, I'm sorry, Dick. When I called in before, I believe I said no after it, at least for now. But thanks again for asking, but I'll be listening on the side. KC2QIQ.
You had a golden opportunity there, Glenn. You could have asked us for anything, like how to get a megabuck. And Rich and I and Mel would have told you how. And we're going to keep that light under our particular bushel basket. Okay. Of all the people who signed in who said they had a real question, I think Steve number two is next. KC2 Mike Delta Papa. Go right ahead, Steve.
Good evening.
You just dropped out there, Steve.
Oh, yeah, I got a problem here with my mic switch. I'm holding it now. Dick, recently I ran into a problem with cable loss. I remember you talking about cable loss a couple of months ago. Basically what's happening is, the S-meter is practically nil on a repeater that I know I get usually a full signal strength on. SWR was fine. Everything was good as far as that. And, basically the cable went bad as far as water and stuff must have got in it or, laying on the roof. And I think the sun might have, did something to the foam inside. Is there any way to check a cable with the antenna connected? Basically, I have one of these, MFJ antenna analyzers that'll give you coax loss. But unfortunately, with that thing, I do believe you got to use it with the antenna disconnected from the feed line. Is there a simple way to check, a cable, for water or some sort of, loss without disconnecting the antenna? Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I got lots of guesses along these lines. Before we proceed, please tell me, Steve, what kind of cable? Is it 9914? Is it RG8 foam or whatever? What kind of cable and roughly how many feet of it? And where it lays across the roof, is it on a slanted roof or a flat roof? Back to you, Steve.
Okay, very good. Yeah, it's RG8 foam. It's not the greatest cable. I bought some LMR400 to eventually replace it. It's laying on the roof. It's probably about 50 feet, and I'd say probably what's laying on the roof is maybe 10 feet, and it is a slope roof. Back to you.
Okay, glad to hear it's a slope roof. If it was a flat roof where you could have a puddle of water and the cable is sitting under the puddle, that can give you a lot of grief. When water gets into a cable and the water is properly distributed, water at RF frequencies is an extremely lossy material. When you operate your microwave oven, you would think the microwaves are cooking the food. The answer is indirectly. Your food almost always contains water. The 2450 megacycles of the microwave oven, nothing magic about that frequency. It was just an available frequency. Nowhere near a water resonance frequency, which is 22 gigs, the first water resonance. So 2.45 gigs with enough strength in that microwave oven. The water does 98% of all the energy absorption. The water gets hot. The water is in your food gets heated. So water is very absorptive. If the water is properly distributed throughout the cable, you could have a cable where it used to be 2 dB per 100 foot, and now it's 22 dB per 100 foot. And I'm not kidding. I've run into that problem. And because the cable has a distributed loss along its length, if the antenna is reasonably functioning yet at the far end of the cable, presenting something close to a 50-ohm load with less than, we'll say, a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, and you use an antenna analyzer at the input end of the cable, what that antenna analyzer is doing is sending a signal down the cable and looking at all the reflection. Well, if the cable is very lossy and not much of the signal is getting to the antenna, and what little bit gets reflection by the antenna gets lost through the cable again on the way back toward the transmitter, you could have an antenna analyzer reading beautiful. It says your cable is between 50 and 51 ohms resistive and there's no reactive component, and yet the cable's got 22 dB of loss. You can see that there's a good probability the antenna analyzer in that circumstance can be fooled into a misdetection. Occasionally when you get water in the cable, particularly if the water is in the connector, and if your kind of antenna is like a dipole, an open circuit DC-wise, and by putting an ohmmeter between center conductor and the shield of the cable, open up the cable at the transmitter, put your ohmmeter in there, and if you read greater than a megohm, most of the time you're all right. If you read something like 10 kiloohms because of water somewhere, then you know you're in a heap of trouble. However, there is the possibility that the water is distributed through the bubbles of the foam, and the water is in the outer bubbles, but it doesn't bridge the gap between center conductor and outer conductor, and therefore the ohmmeter doesn't see the water that's in the foam. Another nasty thing that happens with foam cable is that particularly 9913, but other kinds of foam cable, 9913's got a lot of air in it, the early versions of it, is that the outer polyvinyl chloride jacket, to your and my eye, looks like a beautiful waterproof material. You take a length of that and you put it underwater for a reasonable length of time, no water gets in, and you think everything's hunky-dory. You put polyvinyl chloride outer conductor cable into something that does not have a hermetically sealed foil underneath, like ordinary braided cable with foam. Turns out water vapor does slowly migrate through the polyvinyl chloride outer jacket, even if you've done a perfect job of weatherproofing with a great big ball of tape and spray materials and whatever. You've made each of the connectors waterproof, but the cable itself along the length will leak water. And foam cables and air-filled cables are particularly vulnerable to this. For that reason, I use hardline cable, which doesn't have the problem. You can directly bury it in the underground for 20 years. And the polyvinyl jacket on the outside there is just to make sure there's no additional corrosion of the outer aluminum jacket. It's not there for waterproofing reasons. The hard line itself, the properly installed connectors, is a damn close to a perfect hermetic seal. It's not perfect because the rubber seals on the end leak, but very, very slowly. And so I run hard line cables wherever possible, and where I need a flexible jumper at the end, I would use either something that's super flexible, that's got a corrugated copper outer jacket, like Superflex, and a great big length of it, acting like a watch spring coil, or my other favorite is RG9 or RG214, polyethylene cable. Yes, the polyethylene cable has got a lot more loss compared to foam cable, but I'm only using a couple of feet of it around the rotator as the flexible link. So the lens doesn't get a chance to build up much loss. And the nice thing about solid polyethylene is it will not suck up water. So that's how I get around this problem. So without doing a input-end, output-end power test, or without open-circuiting the far end, when you open-circuit the far end, all energy that gets there, in theory, has to reflect and come back down. And if you measure a reflected power that's 20 dB down with the output end open circuited, that would say you've got 10 dB of loss in each direction on the cable, and it's a pretty good test. So in order to be double darn sure, do the ohmmeter test, but it's not it's a necessary but not sufficient. And the real test is opening the far end and then either putting a power meter at the far end or remeasuring the reflective power with the input end. Looks to me like you're going to most likely be climbing the tower to confirm your cable as I see it, Steve. KC2MDP, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Comment to K2KY.
Stand by, Steve. Mel's been there. Maybe he's got the answer. Go ahead, Mel.
I don't know if he has the availability of a TDA, but you'll be amazed if you know the length of your cable, that how it throws off the TDA indicator. The TDA, you know, if you use a graphic type like ATA cells, you'll see that the main blip on it will indicate the length of the cable, but you'll see a bunch of other things in there, and one of the things that they use is to tell you if your cable is contaminated, Dick, over.
Yeah, you called it a TDA, and I think you mean TDR, time domain reflectometer. Unfortunately, that's an extremely rare device in the ham radio world, and the more sophisticated version of it is a time domain reflectometer simulator, which uses the Steinhelfer technique. We're getting pretty deep here. Steinhelfer is a man who in 1968 invented this beautiful piece of mathematics where if you've got something like an antenna analyzer, which will measure at 1,024 evenly spaced frequencies, it measures the amplitude of the phase of the reflected signal, put it all together in a great big Fourier transform, heavy chunk of mathematics, and it simulates a beautiful time domain reflectometer. Yeah, time domain reflectometer, the reason it can do it, even if the water is distributed and not all bunched in one spot, the TER can still tell you something about the loss of your cable because every realistic antenna you and I are likely to use, Steve, has specific frequencies of resonance. Your 2-meter antenna or your 80-meter antenna tends to operate only on one frequency and odd harmonics of that frequency. It does not have multiple octaves of pure resistive impedance. Therefore, the extremely broad frequency region that you're putting into the cable by way of a TDR. TDR is putting in an extremely fast rise time set of pulses. And those pulses go from DC to light as far as their frequency content is concerned. And if every one of those frequencies is not absorbed at the far end by a perfect dummy load, and your antenna is perfectly tuned to your favorite frequency, but not in between, so it's a lousy dummy load, therefore a lot of those individual frequency components of the fast rise pulse train of a TDR, a high percentage of them get reflected by the antenna. The TDR reassembles that echo back at the input end, and it says, aha, hey Steve, you got a lossy piece of cable because the echo came back the wrong amplitude, the wrong frequency component, and so on. So a TDR would let you know without opening up the cable, but I'll bet you you ain't got a TDR because of all the flea markets I've gone to in all the years, I have never seen one of those being sold on the surplus market.
You can buy a new one for about $600, Dick.
$600, okay.
AEA, cheaper.
AEA has a TDR? What's the price of the AEA, Mel?
Okay, AEA calls it a TDA, a time domain analyzer. That's why I said TDA. It's a graphic. In other words, AEA makes a number of these handheld devices. They have an HF, FWR, you know, analyzer similar to the one that MFJ puts out, except they have a graphic display. It's about, you know, a 3-inch graphic display. You actually see the thing, the line comes across, going up and down. If you could, say, you know, set the actual bandwidth with the AEA analyzer, that's why I like it. For instance, if you want to look at the entire 20-meter band, as far as that antenna is concerned, and it'll show you the different blips and, you know, the trace of how the SWR is along the whole entire band for that antenna. Now they make one like that. They make one for UHF, EHF. UHF, a handheld analyzer like that. And they make one called their TDA, Time Domain Analyzer, which is a cable, basically, just analyzing the cable. And you see the graphic thing going along, and you got a, well, yeah, it's amazing. I took a length of cable, and you could actually damage the cable, you know, put a dent into it, sort of, you know, in other words, distort it. It'll tell you how far away that distortion point is. If you puncture the cable, any damage to the cable, it'll tell you something that's not right at a certain distance. So in other words, it's like a TDR, but it's a graphic display, Dick, over.
What's the approximate price of that machine, if you happen to know, Mel?
Well, when I bought it, they had a deal at that time. They gave me all three. UHF, I think the whole three of them at that time was under $1,000 for the three instruments, three handheld instruments, Dick. So I think they averaged around $300 or so. This was quite a number of years ago. I've got them now about 10 years. So I don't know what the current price is, but it sure is a heck of a handy instrument, to say the least, over.
Boy, that Mel owns a little bit of everything when it comes to test equipment. Wow. Okay. I am going to guess, if I was in Steve's position, I would say, gee, those kind of prices for a piece of test equipment to test the cable, which I only need once per year, that's a little bit steep. However, if I can talk my very progressive local ham radio club into buying one of these or a whole series of these pieces of test equipment, and we, all the club members, share it, boy, that would be a great way to go. So I think we've given you some suggestions. They all require some elbow grease or some dollars. What else is new, Steve? KC2MDB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, Dick, very good. Yeah, that is a bit pricey.
Dick, just a quick question. In your opinion, how long would you let a piece of cable sit outside before you decide to change? You know, how many, you know, would you give it a year, 2 years before you decide to change it to coax outside? Back to you.
Okay, glad you asked. I am particularly not in love with crimped connectors outdoors. Even though it saves you a heap of time when it comes to properly installing a connector, I spend the time, 10 minutes each, putting on a tight end UG21 connector on the end of each time. Each one of my pieces of solid polyethylene RG214 or RG9 cable. And many of those flexible link pieces of cable have been out there 15 years and going. I'm willing to spend an extra 10 minutes putting a connector on each end of the outdoor cable, as long as it's the kind of cable that's going to last, and I'm going to get that kind of service, and therefore I own the cable, it doesn't own me. If I could install some super low loss piece of cable, it's going to be fantastic in performance, but I've got to change it every year, and I've got 1,000 feet of cable going up my 100 foot of power. I don't want to do that. I don't want to spend my life changing cables on the tower. So I don't use foam cables anymore. I don't use air-filled cables anymore, with rare exception, unless I'm willing to pressurize them. I use hardline everywhere I possibly can, and if I need flexible links at the end, I use polyethylene, a solid dielectric cable, or Superflex. That's my philosophy. I want to own the system. I don't want it to own me. Properly installed, properly weatherproofed, they should give you a long life. Now, foam-filled cables. My first experience with foam-filled cables is that beautiful stuff made by ITT, I can't remember, FM8, ITT FM8. I used it for the phasing harness on my 432 array of 16 Yagis, and it was the lowest loss cable of that diameter I could put my hands on way back in 1979 when I built that antenna. And the antenna worked like a charm for the first couple of years. Slowly it degraded, but it degraded so slowly and continuously, I didn't know the difference. When Hurricane Gloria in 1985 blew down the antenna, and all of the facing harness was sitting in my front yard connected to those antennas, and I went out there and measured those cables, every one of those foam-filled ITT high-quality mil-spec cables had all doubled and tripled in insertion loss in dB per foot because of slow water absorption through the polyethylene jacket into the foam. If only one or two of the cables had displayed extra loss, I would say, okay, I did a lousy job of weatherproofing a connector on one end, where all 17 pieces of cable all increased in loss by the exact same amount. I said, wow, I see a common denominator here. Foam-filled cable ain't for me anymore, unless it's got a foil underneath that is a hermetically sealed foil, not just a foil wrap. I'm in favor of foam-filled flexible cable with a foil, and I think LMR has got that. So LMR, I think, has solved the problem, but many of these other less expensive foam-filled braided cables, I don't think hack it, and I won't use them. But that's my opinion. That's just one man's opinion. You pays your money, you takes your choice, Steve. KC2MDP. By the way, when you do measure your cable and find out what's going on, please come back and tell us what you know. We're going to give you a homework assignment. I, for one, am sitting on the end of my chair waiting for the information to find out what happened in your case. You got it, Steve.
Okay, Dick, yeah, very good. That I definitely will do. I just got to get myself back to Pennsylvania to my parents' house and change that piece of cable. The funny thing is, though, is the SWO was beautiful. And I remember you had this discussion a couple of months ago about this, that water got in the cable and the SWO was perfect. So I do thank you for that. That solved my problem as far as that, not knowing the radio was bad and everything else. As far as hardline, I'd like to use hardline, but some places it's just not practical, you know, running, you know, five or six different pieces of hardline into the house and stuff. So, LMR 400, you say, is probably a better cable, so I'll have to keep
that in mind. Once again, Dick, thank you, and back to you.
Okay. I've got 10 pieces of hardline going up my tower feed. To bring 10 pieces of 3/4-inch hardline into the house would be very difficult. Each of those pieces of hardline go up the tower. There's a flexible link of RG9, solid polyethylene cable, equivalent to RG214, at the top of each piece of hardline going around the rotator. The bottom of the hardline comes right up to the window of the shack, and there it transitions again into a piece of RG9, flexible cable, and that's what comes through the dryer vent hole in the side of the wall and comes into my shack. So all the cables in my shack are flexible pieces of, call it RG214, it's really RG9, a mil-spec version of it, or I got a hold of a whole lot of pieces of it. What I like about RG214 and RG9 is it's double braided. And by the way, when you count the number of strands in the double braid, and the inner braid is silver plated, really, it's a very well-constructed cable. Probably installed a connector on the end of that, you can hang your weight from it, and it wouldn't pull off. But the inner braid strands are silver plated, the outer ones are not. And I one day counted all the strands, and I think it's 512 strands in the braid of that cable. What a cable. And when I talked to my buddy Mornford, the Manhinwick, I can't think of his call letters right now, in La Salina, Chile.
X-Q2-F-O-D.
X-Q2-F-O-D. Beautiful, thank you. When I talked to him, the best cable he can buy from Santiago, Chile, has a braid with about 16 strands or some ridiculously low number. The braid on the cable that he can buy in-country probably has about 50% coverage, whereas the double-shielded braid you got on RG214 is the equivalent of 110% coverage, if you know what I mean. Real huge difference. I offered to send him some cable because he runs into a lot of problems with the cable he can buy in-country. He has turned me down because he said it would take a month of Sundays to get a length of cable through customs, and he'd have to bribe everybody in the country before he would get it. So because of the corruption and other problems he has, I can't even send him cable, and he can't get quality cable. He's got to learn to live with the yucky stuff he's got. You and I have access to some darn nice cables, and we should appreciate that. Back to you, Steve.
Yeah, very good, Dick. Yeah, I'll have to keep that in mind. The hard line just come down, and then before I enter the house, to where we're going to coax. Very good. Yeah, the stuff that's up there now that I'm having a problem with was not very good. I got that at the local radio shack, and it's got to be a good 5 years old, I would say, if I've been out in the weather at least 5 years. Back to you.
Yeah, in my case, the foam-filled FM8 ITT cable, mil-spec cable, so to speak, I put it up in 79. Hurricane Gloria blew me down in September of 85. 6 years later, in that six-year period of time, every length of that cable either doubled or tripled. I don't remember the exact numbers, but it was a huge increase in dB per foot. And I'm not afraid at all of using a small length of flexible cable on the end of each end of the hardline. Everyone believes that each individual connector and transition has half a dB of loss. Absolutely, positively not. I personally have measured the insertion loss of a bullet and a barrel, so to speak, of type N connectors and a bullet and a barrel of UG, PL259, SO239 type connectors. And the insertion loss is numbers like 0.04 dB per pair. The only thing that can have loss is something that's really made out of a resistive material or something that's got a whole lot of length to it, like a length of coax cable. When your connector is approximately an inch long, you would have to use all kinds of fancy techniques to give it insertion loss and still pass an ohmmeter test. We have all lost a whole lot of sleep trying damn hard to make sure that the one piece of cable with one single connector at the bottom end coming out of our transmitter goes all the way up to the antenna with one connector at the far end. We've all developed such a fear of multiple connectors and multiple junctions and adapters and whatever. As long as you do a good job of weatherproofing and a good job of making sure that mechanically the connector is held together and it's not going to fall apart with vibration, as long as you meet those two criteria, I wouldn't give it, Don, if you go through 5 connectors and 4 adapters in that system, as long as they're reasonable quality. We have all had an unnatural fear of connectors and adapters. It's unjustified. Strongly felt opinion after a whole lot of measurements and years of that particular philosophy, and it works for me. Okay. Joe is the next person who had a question. KC2, I think it was KI2, K2QYW, I believe it is. Joe, go right ahead. K2RIW in second hand.
Yeah, hi, Roger. Name here is Joe from Harrison, New York, Westchester County. K2QYW. Yes, my question is there like a fire code on how high up the dipole should be? Is there like a minimum, like maybe like 10 feet or 15 feet or so on, back to the net?
Yeah, let me hear what you're thinking on this one is, Joe. When you say fire code, or you really mean zoning code, fire code, UL code, ANSI, American National Standards Institute, National Bureau of Standards, IEEE, all of the great organizations, Underwriters Laboratory. Are you worried about the antenna being so low that people are going to walk into it and that it's going to be too close to the people that they're going to pick up RF radio frequency biohazard? Is that your fear? First of all, when it comes to a fire code, the first thing that anyone would be concerned about is how close is any piece of wire, any piece of conductor, any piece of pipe of your antenna to a power line. If it's within any kind of a distance of a power line, that in the worst case blow down with a Hurricane Gloria coming along or Hurricane Katrina, if any part of your antenna or any of your hardware of your antenna or the guy wires of your antenna or whatever, if anything metallic, conductive, can ever come close to a power line, be very slow and very careful. Because a power line, particularly the high tension lines that do the distribution down your street, which are usually something like 13.2 kilovolts each phase, between phases, 7,800 volts to ground on each phase, you don't want to mess with those. Treat them, I mean, with a 10-foot pole, even if it is a polyethylene plastic pole, if you know what I mean, and thoroughly dry. So that's the first danger. But when it comes to the antenna being low, and if it's an antenna on, let's say, 80 or 40 meters, let me give you some examples of what goes on here. If I had an 80-meter antenna, 132 feet long, and I put a kilowatt of power into it, a kilowatt of power, for all practical purposes, is somewhat evenly distributed across that 132 feet of wire. And I stand under that antenna 5 feet away from it. I'm only in the vicinity of the nearest couple of feet of that wire. The rest of the feet of the wire is 100 feet downrange to the left and 30 feet downrange to the right, if you know what I mean. Because of the physical area of that antenna, a dipole on 80 meters does have a radio area on reception and transmission of 8,500 square feet, effective capture area. And that number is traceable to the Bureau. And you and I could argue about whether or not it's 8,421 or 8,515, depending on what value of pi you use and how much local ground absorption you're getting. Minor differences. So in that case, a kilowatt into an antenna 5 feet away from you, safe as all hell. Now, you put a kilowatt into a 432 corner reflector dipole antenna, tape it down to the bedpost because you're operating from the top of the mountain at the Mount Equinox in Vermont. So now you've got a kilowatt into an extremely small antenna acting like a point source, and it's 5 feet away from you, and you're pouring a gallon into it. That is not a safe antenna. If you run key down for 6 minutes, if you're running single sideband, Morse code, and you're only transmitting for 30 seconds and listening for 2.5 minutes and so on, the amount of radio frequency biohazard, if that's what you're concerned about, has to be integrated over 6 minutes. What was your integrated exposure for 6 minutes? Then you make a judgment about whether or not it is or is not above the MPE, maximum permitted exposure. So what band are we talking about here, and is it radio frequency biohazard? I think if you're on an HF band, 89% of the time, you ain't got a problem as I see it, Joe. KC2QIW, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, Yeah, Roger. Okay, let me answer your first question. Yeah, there's no power lines up there. There's no power lines near the flat roof up there. Yeah, I'm going to use it for HF. It's the most popular band, I guess. 6, 10, 12, 15, 17, 20, 30, 40, 50, I guess 80 meters. From 80 meters all the way down to 60 meters. And I'm going to set up a dipole up there, and I thought there might be a firefighter pole, like maybe 15 feet high above, you know, above the roof up there, you know. So let me pass it back to the net.
Okay. Are you concerned? You haven't told us yet, what is it your specific concern? Is it radio frequency biohazard? Is it catching the roof on fire? What specifically are you concerned about, Joe? Go ahead. Or people running into the antenna by hitting it with their head or neck or whatever? Tell me what you believe is the danger of an antenna not being tall enough. Back to you, Joe.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm concerned about, I guess, like, say if there's a fire and firefighters have to go up on a roof. I guess people, you know, running into it and whatnot. You know, if they need to, sorry about the background noise. You know, if they need to set up a ladder up there or some kind of equipment, safety equipment. God forbid, there's a fire on the roof. I thought maybe 15 feet high should be high enough. So I'm concerned of people, you know, running into it, getting the tow hose out of their way, so to speak.
Okay. As I see it, you've only got to worry about people striking the antenna with portions of their body. And very few people are beyond 7 foot tall. So if your antenna is 10 feet above the roof, except for a guy like Wilt Chamberlain jumping up real high as he runs across your roof, and he getting caught with his neck around your antenna, except for that situation, no problem. So no fireman is that tall. No fireman jumps that high. They ain't going to have a problem. If they're bringing a hook and ladder up to your house, a bucket truck or whatever, and it strikes the wire of your antenna, it'll just yank it right out of the way and rip it out of its moorings. I mean, that's a solid piece of equipment, and your piece of wire is a chintzy little thing by comparison, not to worry. So as long as it's tall enough that it doesn't catch somebody in the neck, you got it made. Stop worrying, in my opinion. So I don't think you've got a problem, unless I misunderstood your question. Now back to you, Joe.
Comment 6, comment W2EWK.
I'll get you in a second, Eugene. Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, that's true. You know, if they need to set a ladder up, it'll just break. You know, the wire will just, you know. Yeah, so we have to over to the other callers. Right now I have a E99 set up there for the E-step band, and then I also have a, you know, like a 2-meter vertical and 440 vertical up there right now. So, vertical is no problem, I guess, because it's just vertical, you know? So let me pass it over to the other station with the comments.
And you've got it, Eugene.
Okay, Dick. My comment is that what happens if an airplane goes by, not a 747, I'm talking like a Piper Cub, or some aliens come by and they fly over. I was concerned about if they're going to hit the cable or the antenna. That's my comment. And if they do hit it, if the aliens hit it, would they just take off, or maybe one of those small aliens will get out and move the antenna? Okay, Dick, please comment on that, W2EWK.
Yeah, Eugene, I think you're testing our gullibility. However, when it comes to an airplane striking your antenna, you're listening to an antenna on the top of 100 feet of tower right now, and I guess the antenna is 5 feet above the top of the tower, so it's 105 feet above the terrain, and I'm on land that's almost 300 feet above sea level. If anybody should worry, my structure should worry about being struck with an airplane. I've called up the FAA, told them where I live, what's my latitude and longitude. They figured out how close I am to all the airports. They told me I could be a lot higher than I am with no sweat. No aircraft in the United States is allowed to be below 1,000 feet above ground level in a residential area. In a rural area where there are no houses, they're allowed to get within 500 feet of the ground. But no aircraft following FAA rules is allowed to be less than 1,000 feet above grade. So the chances of my 105 feet above grade structure being struck by a legal aircraft is near zero. Now, if an aircraft for some reason flies below that level, violating FAA rules because they're in trouble or because the pilot has got very poor judgment, and then he strikes my antenna. He has violated the FAA rules, and I'm not considered at fault. He is.